Hello there, Mike. Thank you. And hello there, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to another edition of Broken Bread. This is the regular Bible study that Mike Coles from newliferadio.co.uk and myself, Ron Bailey from BibleBase.com, where we conspire together in love week by week to bring to you these studies. And currently we're studying the book that I wrote some years ago called The Better Covenant, and we've called this a study guide. And if you've not been with us before, you're actually joining us in study number 22, which we're calling Conflict Among the Covenants. We'll make a start, shall we? So think about an introduction first. We've arrived, if you're following this along in your copy of The Better Covenant, we've arrived at chapter 8 in The Better Covenant, and we begin to discover some of the tensions that can develop between the advocates of different covenants. We're developing quite a collection of covenants, and we've seen that not all covenants are watertight. Some covenants are absolutely standalone covenants, but others seem to coexist quite happily with one another. In fact, they didn't always coexist happily, and tensions developed among the different covenants along the line of party interests. We'll explain this as we go on. Different groups quoted different covenants to justify their positions. And it has to do mainly with the question of covenants, whether they are conditional or non-conditional. What do we mean by that? Well, some Christians make a strong distinction between two kinds of covenant. The divisions between Calvinism and Arminianism are part of this struggle in some ways. Some, wishing to emphasize the power and rule of God, describe some of these covenants as being one-directional or non-conditional. They make the point that many ancient covenants were not mutual, but usually had a pattern where the ruler or conqueror imposed his will upon the conquered, whether they liked it or not. Others, wishing to emphasize man's accountability, stress the required faith or obedience of the other covenant party. This emphasis on the mutual nature of a covenant is what we mean by a conditional covenant. And in case you haven't noticed, I've been taking the second line in these particular studies. That's to say that covenants are essentially conditional. Covenants are relationships between at least two parties. It is true that the covenant that followed the flood was not a mutual agreement in that sense. That covenant is later described as an everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. Genesis 9, verses 15 to 17. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it, that I may remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, This is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth. But if we look a little bit deeper, in some senses there are covenants, conditions built into this one as well. For example, in Genesis chapter 9, verses 4 to 6, God has said this. He's bringing them out, and they're beginning their new life, the other, this side of the flood. And then he says, but flesh with the life thereof, he's just told them that they can eat flesh now. Before that, they'd been vegetarian, essentially. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, ye shall not eat. And surely your blood, the blood of your lives, will I require at the hand of every beast, will I require it, and at the hand of man, even at the hand of every man's brother, will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. Sounds as though what we might have called capital punishment was built into that covenant. You say, well, it doesn't seem to be working. God is still not flooding the earth. We're still seeing his bow. Yes, yeah, sometimes judgment takes a long time in coming, as the judgments begin to fall upon the earth in Revelation. In chapter 18 and verse 24, it says, "And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all who were slain on the earth." It's not over until it's over. The Abrahamic covenant is described as a standalone or a non-conditional covenant sometimes. But on closer examination, we discover that this covenant had conditions. Abraham had taken many steps of faith. Do you remember? That's almost where we began. That when Paul wrote about Abraham, he spoke about the steps of the faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. So there have been many steps of Abraham, many steps of faith, although some of them are particularly significant. In the record in Genesis 15, this is the covenant that undergirds the truth, the really fundamental truth of justification by faith. It is, if you like, a proof text quoted frequently in the New Testament, and it has its origins here in the events of Genesis chapters 15 to 17. It says in Genesis chapter 15, and people look upon this as one of the first aspects of the major Abraham covenant. It's actually God's covenant with Christ, if you remember one of our earlier studies. And he believed in Jehovah, and he reckoned it to him for righteousness. That's Genesis 15 and verse 6. That's the classic proof text. But a little bit later on in that chapter, it says, "And it came to pass, when the sun went down, and it was dark, that behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between those pieces." And as we saw in studies 14 and 15, which you can get from Mike Coulter's archives or from Bible Base or from your podcasts, as we saw in studies 14 and 15, this covenant was really between God and Abraham's seed, not primarily. It was made with Abraham, but its topic was God and God's seed. Genesis 15 and verse 18. "In that day Jehovah made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land." And then in Galatians, Paul adds this inspired commentary. "Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises given." He does not say, "and to seeds, as of many, but as of one, and to your seed, who is Christ." A little bit later on in that same chapter, he says, "What purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made." So according to this further revelation, that promise that God made with Abraham, it was actually a promise before that, in a sense, that God made with the seed. And I'm not going to go through that again. You'll need to go back to studies 14 and 15 if you need to refresh your memory. And who doesn't? Then in Genesis chapter 16, we have the Ishmael saga. Now Abraham's wife had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abraham, "See now, Jehovah has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarah. Genesis 16, 1 and 2, verses 1 and 2. Then in Genesis chapter 17, we've got the place where the covenant is sealed by circumcision. Circumcision becomes the seal of the covenant. But the extraordinary thing is, that Genesis chapter 17 is 15 years later than Genesis chapter 15. It's 15 years later than that time when God said, according to Abraham's faith, Abraham believed in the Lord and it was counted to him for righteousness. From the time that Abraham was justified by faith in that encounter with God to the time when a covenant was sealed between God and Abraham, and the seal, the evidence of the seal, was circumcision, was 15 years later, after the disaster of Ishmael. It was then that God entered into the Abrahamic covenant, and this required Abraham to commit to a blameless walk before God. You see, this is how it starts off in Genesis chapter 17. When Abraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abraham and said to him, I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. That is not justification by works. It's just simply saying that the covenant does have conditions. Abraham was to walk before God and be blameless. Abraham didn't have the law, but he walked before God, and as God made his will known to Abraham, Abraham was required to keep it. There is a sense in which we are committing ourselves to God to be his people and to do his will, and it's that kind of faith that is justifying faith. I said the title of this particular section was Conflict Among the Covenants. So this little section I'm moving on to now is entitled by me, I Will Not Forsake You. I Will Forsake You. If we recall the last few chapters of Deuteronomy, they contain several sections which have become sources of blessing and encouragement for God's people, the saints, in all ages. The words ring with absolute certainty. This is how Joshua received them. Be strong and of good courage. Fear not, nor be affrighted at them. For Jehovah thy God, he it is that doth go with thee. He will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. I'll read that little bit again, and then we'll carry on. He will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. And Moses called unto Joshua and said unto him, in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of good courage, for thou shalt go with this people into the land which Jehovah hath sworn unto their fathers to give them, and thou shalt cause them to inherit it. And Jehovah, he it is that doth go before thee. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed. Surely there can be no doubt that settles the matter. Well, it might have done. It might have settled the matter. Except a few verses later, God says, Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 17, then my anger shall be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and will hide my face from them. And they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall come upon them, so that they will say in that day, are not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? There can be no doubt in what's been said here. It's the same Hebrew word used in both places. So how do we get from I will not forsake you to I will forsake them in just 10 verses? Well, in studies 19 and 20, A Day in the Life of Moses, we saw Moses' final words to the covenant nation of Israel. We saw Jehovah's anticipation and delight in the people that he had made his own by covenant. We saw his plan for their destiny as Jeshurun, my upright one. That's Deuteronomy and Isaiah too. But as the record continues, it shows the nations becoming fat and kicking against God's purpose for them. It predicts that they will become complacent in their blessings and will forget God. They will forget Jehovah and the covenant, and turned to other gods. How true that old saying is, God gives and forgives, while man gets and forgets. They are warned that God will heap disasters upon them that will result in them being scattered among their enemies. It's a sobering fact that for all the wonderful promises held out to Jeshurun, God's special name for his covenant people, there are more curses threatened than promises given in the book of Deuteronomy. Here's another little section. I have loved you. So, when God predicts that they will reject him and there will be consequences in which he will not be with them and he will forsake them, does this imply that God will run out of patience and withdraw his love from them? Not at all. The old covenant record will begin and end on the same note. Moses declares God's heart in giving the law. This is Deuteronomy chapter 33, verses 1, 2, 3. And this is the blessing wherewith Moses, the man of God, blessed the children of Israel before his death. And he said, Jehovah came from Sinai and rose from Seir unto them. He shined forth from Mount Paran, and he came from the 10,000s of holy ones. At his right hand was a fiery law for them. Yea, he loved the people. All his saints, God's Jeshurun people, are in thy hand, and they sat down at thy feet. Every one shall receive of thy words. I love the way those two thoughts come together at the end of verse 2 and at the beginning of verse 3. At his right hand was a fiery law for them. Yea, he loves the people. The law, you see, was the gift of God's love for Jeshurun. But we've already seen that there's an epitaph in the final Old Covenant book of Malachi. Malachi chapter 1 and verse 2 says, I have loved you, saith Jehovah. Yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith Jehovah? Yet I loved Jacob. But Esau I hated, and made his mountains a desolation, and gave his heritage to the jackals of the wilderness. And just a few verses later on, you get this heart-stricken cry of God. Oh, that there were one among you that would shut the doors, that ye might not kindle fire on my altar in vain. I have no pleasure in you, saith Jehovah of hosts, neither will I accept an offering at your hand. The book of Malachi is written to, essentially, to the priests, who God calls in that particular prophecy. The people that are his to do his work, his messenger. Those who held the responsibility to guard and guide in the covenant of Levi failed in their God-given responsibility. And God had continued to speak through prophets, originally known as seers, men and women who had God's perspective and saw as God sees. That's what a prophet is. They brought God's perspective to the present time. God's urgency in getting his word to his people through the prophets is captured in the prophet Jeremiah in a pointed idiom. Jeremiah frequently remarks that God was in the habit of getting up early and sending his messengers. And there are more than half a dozen references to that, which, if you have the notes, you can follow through. It's the picture of a hands-on ruler who starts the day early by sending out his heralds personally to his servants. So God never stopped loving them, has never stopped loving them. But some of the promises that were made cannot be kept if the people fail in their part of the covenant. Then we come into what I'm calling the descent into decadence. This is a little potted history. The monarchy that began initially with Saul and then moved on to David, the monarchy that began with such high hopes had brief flashes of the glory that God had promised. But Saul crashed and burned, and David's own sin brought the judgment of a sword into his own family. His last years were plagued with inter-family factions. Solomon started so well, but betrayed all the instructions of Deuteronomy in a lavish lifestyle and squandered his gifts of wisdom. In the next generation, Solomon's son Rehoboam moved yet another step closer to a despotic monarchy of the kind, no doubt, that he saw around him. And God tore the nation from him, leaving him only a tattered remnant in his hands. The nation split into two distinct nations, the house of Israel in the north and the house of Judah in the south. And God made an astonishing promise to Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam had been mixed up in a bit of a kind of a rebellion earlier on, and then when Solomon died, he comes with that question, the famous question to Rehoboam, asking Rehoboam to guarantee that his reign will be less harsh than Solomon's. And Rehoboam takes his counsel from two groups of people. The young princes who'd grown up in the purple and no doubt all the splendor and lavish lifestyle of Jerusalem. And he says, "What shall I do?" And they said, "Tell them that you'll be stronger than your father ever was. If you thought that was tough, now wait and see what happens." And then the older men came, and he asked them, "What shall I do?" And they said, "If you serve this people, they will be your servants forever." This is 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 37 and 38, and it is the prophecy, the promise that God sends to Jeroboam, and it says this: "I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all that thy soul desireth, and thou shalt be king over Israel." Now, just a minute. Didn't God promise that David's dynasty would be everlasting? And yet here God is speaking to this man, Jeroboam, and it says, "And I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all that thy soul desireth, and shall be king over Israel. And it shall be," now listen to this promise that God sends by the prophet, "and it shall be, if thou wilt hearken," notice the condition, "if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and wilt walk in my ways, and do that which is right in mine eyes, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, that I will be with thee, and will build thee a sure house, as I built for David, and I will give Israel unto thee." It's breathtaking. God is speaking to this man, this rebel as he had been. And he says, "If you do this and this and this, then live your life as David did in submission to me, I will be with thee and will build thee a sure house as I built for David." Do you remember how we said last week that God made this amazing promise to David that he would build him a sure house, an everlasting, was the word, dynasty, a Davidic line that would go on forever? And now God makes the same promise to Jeroboam. I'll read it again, and it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee. It's 1 Kings 11, verse 37 to 38. I'll go back a verse. And I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all that thy soul desireth, and shalt be king over Israel. And it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and wilt walk in my ways, and do that which is right in mine eyes, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, then I will be with thee, and will build thee a sure house, as I built for David, and will give Israel unto thee. God has replicated the promises he had given to David and offered them now to Jeroboam. It's one of the great what-ifs of the Bible history. This is a startling prophecy and promise. God offers a replica covenant to Jeroboam, a sure house, a dynasty, as I built for David, and will give Israel, as the northern state, unto thee. So let's come on to the next heading, a confusion of covenants. I don't know that that's the plural noun for covenants, a confusion of covenants, but here we are, a confusion of covenants. We now have two covenants, one to the Davidic dynasty and one to Jeroboam and his dynasty, running side by side, that seem to be incompatible. How are we to understand this? Israel had been given away. David's dynasty will reign over a mere rump of a nation. Bible readers will be familiar with the description of Jeroboam. His frequently described label is Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. He becomes a new standard for idolatry and false religion, so that many a later king is measured against either David or Jeroboam. And you'll find list as it goes on through Kings and Chronicles, and it'll say this one walked in the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin, or he walked in the ways of David. As it happened, Jeroboam's sure and enduring dynasty lasted for a very short time. He reigned for 22 years, during which he took the northern kingdom, Israel, the house of Israel, further and further away from the covenant. His son reigned for 2 years. Jeroboam kind of set up a fake alternative Israel. God would have made his kingdom what he'd promised it to be, but Jeroboam was afraid that if people kept trickling back to Jerusalem for the big services and all the big meetings and all the paraphernalia of priesthood, that their hearts would be lost to the southern kingdom and he would lose his people. So he put idols in the north and the south, and he instituted a fake priesthood, didn't even bother to stick to the line of Levi. So he reigned for 22 years, during which he took the northern kingdom, the house of Israel, further and further away from the covenant. His son reigned for 2 years and was assassinated in the palace coup. The northern nation-state of Israel, and it was a God-ordained, God-initiated nation-state. We shall hear the phrase later on when God promises they will no longer be two states, two nations. The northern nation-state of Israel was on a flight path to disaster. And in spite of God rising up early and sending his messengers to his covenant people, the nation-state of Israel stayed on the same bearing, and the nation-state of Israel, the house of Israel, ended 200 years later, when the Assyrians, the superpower of the day, moved in, and its 10 tribes were taken captive and decanted into the emperor Empire of Assyria. As one historian described it, Israel, the 10 tribes, passed from history into myth. Its people were assimilated into the wider empire of Assyria. And one of the northern kingdom's prophets, because God did send prophets to them, Amos, in chapter 5 and verse 2, raises this lament as he witnesses the disaster that befell the northern kingdom. The virgin of Israel is fallen. She shall no more rise. She is cast down upon her land. There is none to raise her up. And the southern kingdom of Judah, the house of Judah, was on a similar trajectory, just travelling at a slower speed. But we'll need to leave that story until next week. How are we to understand this apparent confusion amongst the covenants? We'll find out next week. Thank you so much for being with us. We really enjoy your company. And God willing, we look forward to your company next week, same place, same time. God bless you.